Hey everyone, it's Jeff Horwich, and this is not actually an episode of In the Loop. I'm speaking only to people listening to the podcast right now, or maybe people who download the episode manually online. In the Loop is off this week. Sandin went to visit his family in Ohio, and since that pretty much is our entire staff, aside from me, we're going to take the week off and enjoy a little quiet time. What we are going to do for you, though, is bring you four more stories from our Story Slam the other day. You remember last week, I think, we put out the one-hour official broadcast version of the Story Slam. Well, every now and then, there are a number of other stories that we just can't help ourselves but bring to you, and this is one of those times. Runs about a half an hour, maybe 35 minutes, as I recall. These are more or less untouched. We haven't done a lot of editing to them, except for maybe adding a bleep in one case. And I'm just going to warn you, the first three storytellers here more or less stick to our five-minute guideline for Story Slam stories. The fourth, not so much, runs a little bit long. It's well told and very colorful, but there was just no cutting it down. And so there it is in all of its glory. Just be prepared for that last one. Runs a little long. Okay, that's all the preamble that should be necessary. I hope you enjoy these remaining stories. Of course, if you haven't heard the first official hour of the Story Slam, go to our website, minnesotapublicradio.org. You can find that there, download it, and enjoy that one as well. All right, hope everybody has a happy new year. And we will see you again January 9th with a new show. Sarah Martin, welcome back to the Story Slam.
Well, thank you for having me, Jeff.
Says here on my little slip of paper, you're addicted to news about the terrible economy.
Oh, I am.
Most of us just want to turn it off, make it go away, think about something else.
It's like a train wreck. It really, really is. I can't stop listening to NPR.
Is it public radio that especially keeps you
really
hooked
is.
On it?
It really is, yeah. It's a problem.
Do you have a favorite dreary economy voice on public radio these days?
You know, I think the person who makes me laugh the hardest, and I'm going to forget her name because I'm really nervous, is the gal who does Planet Money. There's a gal and a guy. Okay. She makes me laugh, and that's really
NPR
necessary.
Podcast.
Yeah.
Makes you laugh in the midst of all this?
Yeah.
One thing I've thought about as we've been going through this is that people must be learning a lot about economics and finances and things like that.
I had no idea what commercial paper was until a month ago.
See? Are you glad to have that knowledge?
No.
Ignorance is bliss. Sarah Martin, thanks very much for joining us again on the Story Slam.
The year is 2003. I am in the kitchen of my Aunt Michelle's house in Buffalo, Minnesota, and it is my first Christmas as a vegetarian. Let me lay a little groundwork for all of you. My uncles hunt. And sometimes when I pass by, I hear them talking about crop rotation and tractor maintenance. My mother was the one who left for the big city, and I am her only child. So at the big events, Easter, Christmas, some cousin's graduation party, I already stand out. I am not and have never been Catholic. I don't go to mass. I'm into spoken word and performance art. The color and length of my hair is at times unpredictable. And now I don't even eat meat. Food is important in my family. Spending a whole day on the shape and texture of your rum balls is encouraged. And there are 30 of us on a good year, and more with the older cousins starting to bring their boyfriends. But this year, my boyfriend is back home in Quincy with his family, and I am unsupervised. I quit eating meat 6 months ago in the throes of love and the delicious self-righteousness at the Winnipeg Folk Festival, and I have spent those 6 months convincing myself and everyone else otherwise that this had been my choice. It had nothing to do with Josh and his politics. I'm a feminist, goddammit, and I don't change my life for some man, right? I know where meat comes from, and I'm going to make sure you know it too, Mom. I know what happens to the small intestine of a school-aged child when he or she consumes a chunk of raw hamburger the size of an olive. And yes, I think dinner is the perfect time to bring that up. Only now it's Christmas, and Christmas is potluck. I'm in Aunt Michelle's kitchen, making a minor show to take only the cheese and crackers that are diametrically farthest from the summer sausage. Next to the meat and cheese tray is Aunt Marie's seven-layer taco dip, or as I have labeled it, meat dip. Behind me, there stands a brave row of white and brown flowered crockpots, barbecue meatballs, Swedish meatballs, little smokies, or as I call them, ball meat, Swedish ball meat, and stick meat the shape and size of an index finger. There's a pan full of turkey for turkey sandwiches, and trust me when I say I pity those of you who have been forced to eat holiday turkey all of your lives and are not immediately related to me. Grandma's turkey pulls apart like roast pork. It's juicy and tender and drips delicate trails of scalding hot grease down your chin. It's divine. Everyone has sort of migrated to the living room. The presents are starting to come out. There are warm rolls near the turkey pan. And no one will ever know. I take one of the rolls and I nibble at a corner before ripping off a hunk and dragging it through the glistening pool of turkey fat. I only get that one bite in before one of the cousins comes through to refill her plate. I move casually away when I am suddenly ambushed by cocktail shrimp. My first true seafood love since childhood, utterly forgotten since June. I sneak half a dozen saucy shrimp into a red and green ho-ho-ho napkin and slink off to the master bathroom. It feels a little like sneaking off to have sex with the best man at your best friend's wedding. You'd hate for her to catch you, but can't help but think if she did, she'd be a little proud. I went home with my folks an hour later. The illness did not set in until almost midnight. That sort of roiling pain in your gut that makes you wish you could run for the bathroom without the sudden movement causing you to hurl down your reindeer pajamas. I thought maybe I had shellfish poisoning, and the irony of that did not escape me. But really, I figured it was exactly what I had been told. That what was happening to my body after it was purified by a better life was rejecting animal flesh. After a while, it passed. And if I thought I'd sworn off meat before, this time I was sticking to it. And it did stick for 4 more years. And I was so embarrassed by that episode, I never told anyone what happened. The shame, the guilt, the very thought of it made my stomach turn all over again. Which is funny, because when I finally did go back to eating meat, when it was really my choice, I didn't get sick at all.
Thank you. Sarah Martin. With me now on stage, Gabe Heller. Gabe, welcome back.
Oh, thank you.
Always nice to see you. I've got a few notes about you here. Mm-hmm. Since you just finished a book, now would you be writing one or reading one?
Writing one.
No kidding.
Yes.
Tell me.
Well, it's called Bestseller by Gabe Heller. And it's
taking the staggering work of stupefying genius.
Something like that. It's actually the first 10 pages of a bunch of would-be bestsellers that are actually parodies of various kinds of bestsellers. The self-help book, the fantasy book, that sort of thing.
Are you at all concerned that that might be unsatisfying for a reader who wants more out of one of your particular titles? Or is this maybe a test to see which of these books you should actually write?
I hope they don't want more because I put all the jokes in the first 10 pages.
Oh, well, it sounds like a fascinating concept. It doesn't surprise me that such a thing would spring from your brain, having heard your stories over these many months. So, welcome back to the Story Slam.
Thank you.
Gabe Heller, Festive Indigestion, our theme tonight.
So, Christmas 2000 was a very special Christmas for me. I lived in St. Paul on and off for 6 years, but it wasn't until I found my car had been stolen overnight that I really felt like a citizen of the Twin Cities. I called the most likely culprit, the city of St. Paul. They may take my car more often than actual thieves and charge me more than I paid for it to get it back, but at least they're predictably bureaucratic about it, and I can usually get it back in less than a couple days for more than a couple days' wages. When they said they didn't have it, I called the police. They didn't have it either, but they said they'd keep an eye out for it. I asked them on average how long it takes them to find a stolen car. I was looking for a completely unofficial guesstimate so I could plan my life, but they took it as an official request and denied it. Welcome to the Twin Cities, I thought, where officials are so afraid you'll turn out to be an asshole they dare not be too helpful. While waiting for the police to retrieve my car, I thought I should prepare myself for what damage might have been done to it, so I looked up online how to jack a 1983 Chevy Celebrity. It turns out you can do it quite easily with minimal damage using two flathead screwdrivers. If only a certain Melvin Lamont Downs Jr. had known that, I might have been spared a great deal of trouble. That is, if Melvin Lamont Downs Jr. actually exists. I have my doubts. I doubt anyone would ever actually name their child Melvin Lamont Downs Jr. The police say they found him in my car, but he wasn't in my car when I got it back. Instead, there were pieces of my steering column and a packet of Frosted Mini Donuts. The latter I ate with gusto. However, I never got to meet my unwilling benefactor, and I wanted to. Among other things, I wanted to know he actually existed, that he hadn't just been invented by the police to make themselves look good and cover up some big city car pirating scheme a la Linkin Park, Chicago, 1970. More than that, I wanted to look him in the eye. I wanted to hear his story and not buy it. Most of all, I wanted to tell him how you steal a 1983 Chevy Celebrity without ripping open the steering column. Because if you do rip open the steering column, the police do not give the car back to its owner when they catch you. No, they have it towed to their impound lot because it may be inoperable, ignoring the fact that you were operating it when they arrested you. And the impound lot charges the owner towing and storage fees to get it back just as if it had been parked illegally, and extra if there happens to be a snow emergency. As it may be inoperable, they do not allow the owner to drive it out of the lot. Oh no, they insist that he pay yet another tow truck to tow it, and not to his home where he might actually manage to fix it himself cheaply. No, only to a repair shop will they let it be towed. This makes sense perhaps if you don't know, as I found out, that repair shops do not know how to fix steering columns. Locksmiths do, because unlike repair shops, they replace steering columns whenever someone loses their car keys. So here's a tip, if this ever happens to you, have your car towed to a repair shop that has a locksmith next door. Or your cruise control and windshield wipers will never work properly again. From that day, my windshield wipers would only come on when I hit a bump or drove sufficiently close to a power switching station. That is what I would have told Melvin Lamont Downs Jr. had I met him. But I didn't get to meet him for two reasons. First, the city rushed the case through. Possession of stolen property, guilty, first offense, 120 hours of community service. Next, second, my car was evidence. And they couldn't give it to me until it wasn't. But without a car, there was no way I could make it to the trial. Welcome to the Twin Cities, I thought again, where the bureaucracy is compartmentalized for your inconvenience. My only recourse was to fill out a form, wherein I detailed all the money the impound lot, the towing company, and the repair shop got out of me. It came to over $600. Over 600 times what I had paid for the car. They told me that if Mr. Downs Jr. didn't pay me, the amount would be automatically deducted from his income tax rebate. That is, if he ever overpays his taxes, if he ever files an actual tax return, if he ever works on the books rather than simply taking to a life of crime, if he actually exists. It's midnight, December 28th, 2000. The car was found in Minneapolis, so I'm waiting at the Minneapolis impound lot. Getting your car back from the city of Minneapolis is different from getting it back from the city of St. Paul. The money they save you in lower fees is made up for by long lines and Machiavellian fine schedules. But at midnight, even on the night of a snow emergency, there are no lines inside the building, not yet. The owners of these cars don't even know they're gone. The lines are outside and are of laden tow trucks coming in and empty ones leaving. Tow trucks too busy hauling away other people's cars to be bothered to haul mine back. At least not for another 6 hours, which is coincidentally 2 hours before the snow emergency parking rules switch in St. Paul, but 3 hours before the repair shop opens. It's 6 a.m., December 29th, 2000. For now, my car is parked legally, but in another 2 hours, the St. Paul police will haul it off to their impound lot if I can't figure out how to start it myself despite the broken steering column. The internet does not hold forth. I hear the far-off sound of the snow plows. They're getting louder. I see the distant flashing lights of tow trucks. I run to the door of the repair shop. It may not be officially open, but they're smart enough in the morning of a snow emergency to have someone answering the phones. I bang on it. He comes to the door. I draw his attention to the location of my car and the sound of approaching plows. "You're in luck," he says. "One of the mechanics came in early today. I'll see if he knows what to do." 5 minutes later, a big guy with a bleary frown sticks his fingers into my steering column, pulls some kind of lever, and my crippled car sputters to life. "Wow," I say. "If you show me how to do that, I wouldn't have to get the steering column fixed." He rolls his eyes, spits on the ground, and drives my car into the shop. Welcome to the Twin Cities. Welcome to the new millennium. Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
Gabe Heller.
Thank you.
Here at the Lab Theater in Minneapolis, it's the Story Slam from In the Loop. Our theme this evening, festive indigestion. I'm Jeff Horwich, and next with me is Courtney McLean. Courtney, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Jeff.
Glad to see you. We haven't met before, have we?
I think this will be your first Story Slam. Yep.
It says here you play banjo.
I do. Feel my fingers.
Calloused?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Very nice. What inspired you to pick up the banjo?
I was listening to a certain musical artist, Sufjan Stevens. Mm-hmm. He's got a lot of banjo in his music, and I was like, I think the banjo is my soul instrument.
Has it worked out that way for you?
Yeah, I've been playing for about a year. It's awesome.
Wow. Yep. All kinds of things we could pull out of our hats. And we asked you about a holiday tradition, I guess, in your family, maybe, on your way to the stage. Mm-hmm. And it says, Christmas crackers. What are they?
For years, my mother is British, and she was trying to find, they're sort of these paper roll things that look like a giant candy that you pull apart and they make a pop.
Oh, sure.
And inside, they've got like a little plastic toy and a little like paper hat. Mm-hmm. So she finally found them, and we've been doing this for years where we pull out the paper hat and my entire family wears these paper hats while we eat Christmas dinner. And we actually have this weird picture of all of us with the hats pulled down over our eyes and our hands behind our chairs like we're hostages.
Mm-hmm.
Christmas at the McLean house.
Yeah, that plus you in the corner playing the banjo makes right? you really normal. Courtney McLean, welcome to the Story Slam.
Thank you. Have at it. I'm a sucker for three things on a menu that will make me order an item regardless of what it has in it. Guacamole, sour cream, which is awesome because I could usually get both of them together, and leafy greens, by which I do not mean lettuce in any form. I am a sucker for leafy greens because they make me think that I am doing my body a favor, even when it's the spinach and eggs Florentine. So three Christmases ago, I was on my first visit to the cities, and my friends and I were in the hot tub. The water was delicious on our squirmy bodies while we were in varying degrees of nudity floating about under the moonlight through the window. The smoke flowed freely, bringing on the need for a very late night food run. So we piled into the van and drove out to sit under garish fluorescent lights and above plates of brown, orange, and yellow breakfast food. I had a slight ache in my heart because I knew we were in the last hour of our after party as the sky started to lighten. I ordered eggs Florentine to counter the warm shades of fried food coming our way. We ate and laughed and ate some more and laughed some more and futzed about the bill and took some pictures and laughed some more. On the way home, I felt a surge of pain in my intestinal region. I felt this surge many times before, and usually means I've eaten something unfavorable and must get to a toilet ASAP. My foot weighed slightly more heavily on the gas to take me to my place of hospitality in downtown St. Paul in a timely manner. You see, when I was 17 years old, I was driving home from a post-rehearsal hangout session at Taco Bell, and I felt the surge too far away from home, and instead of stopping to pull over at a gas station to use the bathroom, my body rebelled, leaving me sitting in a lair of my own waste, sobbing while I drove home. I ran into the arms of my mother, ashamed. And 17 years wasn't too long to forget how to change her child's poopy pants. And she graciously took my underwear and shorts while I snuck into the bathroom to wash up before my little brother could make fun of me. And here I was again, pulling into the city limits of the capital's downtown, fighting the oncoming flood with my muscles in the desperate endeavor not to have a repeat of those events. All of a sudden, I was regretting my escapades in our nation's capital at another festival a week earlier. Escapades that had involved a man and my saying yes to activities that had nothing to do with reproduction. Had I somehow weakened my chances of winning against the mounting rage coursing through my insides? Had I widened the gap enough to where I couldn't fully close it again? My hands gripped the steering wheel as I guided the car into the final turn onto the driveway. I scrambled out of the car, fingering my way to the house key as the light of the dawn grew, no longer giving me the cloak of night. Should I? This damn key! Unlock the door! I turned and turned and turned, but this was one of those locks with which you must calmly breathe and close your eyes and pray while gently clicking open the lock. But obviously, I had no capacity to be calm with my sphincter muscles working overtime to... fail. Right there on the porch of my friend. My body, for the second time in my life as an adult, failed me. I was 28 years out of diapers, and I could feel the warmth of my semi-digested eggs Florentine dribble down my legs and soak through my jeans. I stood there in my own filth for an introspective second, flashing back to a time perhaps when I wet my bed in an age where I should have known better, and devising a plan to quietly get upstairs to the only shower in the house, the path to which had to take me through my host's bedroom. Of course, now, with my muscles finally relaxed, did I get the key to work. And I slowly climbed the creaky staircase, but with enough expediency so as to not allow the putrid smell of crap to diffuse throughout the house. I stood inside the bathtub, peeling off my stained socks and soaked pants, holding my breath so my gag reflex wouldn't invite another outpouring of bodily fluids, cranked on the water, and rinsed and rinsed and rinsed. Through the door came the timid, sleepy voice of my host. Are you okay, Courtney? Yes, I just had a little accident. Understatement of the season. Thank you.
Courtney MacLean. We are back with the In the Loop Story Slam. Jake Weissman, thanks very much for joining us.
How you doing?
Older brother of our bass player back here.
Yeah, Joe said I wasn't allowed to tell anybody I was his brother until after I told my story.
Oh, did I spill the beans?
Well, just to see if they reacted well. Then I'm his brother. If they didn't, I wasn't supposed to say anything.
Well, you guys have pretty much the same build. I mean, I would... It's pretty clear to just about anybody looking at you that you're related. You're into lifting, yeah?
Yeah, I'm my friends tell me I'm the one guy lifting weights doesn't work for. My training partner Andy benches 850 pounds, three-time world record holder. I was really depressed the other day, and I'm saying, dude, I've been doing this 30 years, and I'm half as strong as you. He put his arm around me and said, Jake, you're not half as strong as me. You're not even a third as strong as me. So I felt better. I felt a lot better.
Well, it looks like it's working for you.
Yeah, I was 127 pounds when I started, though.
No kidding?
Yeah.
Wow.
I looked like, I look bad.
And another note I have about you here says you've spent the last couple of Christmases in Asia.
What yeah, I work for a Hong Kong-based company, and nobody wants to go to China in the summer. All my customers want to go to China in the winter because it's really hot in the summer, and it's warm there now. And my company doesn't seem to care a lot about Christmas. They're big Chinese New Year fans, so they tend to keep us there as long as they can after the customer meetings. So the funny thing is the story I'll tell, I decided 10 minutes ago what story I'd tell, but I was inspired because we had Danes and we had Chinese food, and I thought, well, I got a great story about Danes and Chinese food, so I can tell that story. As far as the 5 minutes goes, I can't order at a restaurant less than 10 minutes, so I got no chance of hitting that. But, you know, as soon as she drags me off, I'm cool, you know.
Okay. Well, our weightlifter, Jake Weissman, is going to be dragged off the stage a little later by Anna down here with the flashlight. All right, well, in as quick a fashion as you're able, Jake Weissman, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. I took two Adderall before this so I can speak really fast so I can try to get through this. So I was in Hong Kong one time. I won't do that. I spent a lot of time in China, a lot of time in Asia, and I'm pretty convinced that I can speak Mandarin now. And I tend to stay with that regardless of the consequences. The story I'll tell about is a celebratory dinner that I was invited to after we landed the Dell account. For those of you who aren't into electronics, landing Dell is a lot like landing Dell. And it was a pretty cool time. After the 3-day audit, we ended about noon, and I decided to ask the women that had performed the audit if they wanted to eat something in Mandarin. What I meant to say is, Nishang ker ma, which would be, you want eat ma, which means question. A little nervous, and instead of saying ni, I said wa, which means me. That wouldn't have been too bad, because I would have still said, I want to eat question. Instead of ma, which means question, I said mao. Body hair. Yeah. The two most powerful women in Dell. They're strong women, and they're women that you don't say, hi, I'd like to eat your body hair, which I just said. The reaction I got was startling. Molly, who I've always been a little bit scared of, bent in double laughing so hard, turned all sorts of colors, gasping for air, couldn't breathe. Eileen, who I always kind of thought liked me, started hitting me. What did you say to me? And I said, I want to eat your body hair again, because I thought it meant, do you want to eat lunch? She made me swear never to try to speak Mandarin again. When Molly told me what I had said, actually, this picture of myself working at Walmart. Would you like a cart, sir? The old guy next to me, I thought you said you had a job where you traveled the world. Well, I did. What'd you do? Well, I told the two most powerful people at Dell that I want to eat their body hair. Why'd you do that? I don't know. I survived that. And I'm feeling pretty down. It's Christmas. I'm in Asia. My two bosses asked me if I want to go out to dinner with them. I'm like, dude, where do you want to go? They're like, oh, we got this great bar. They've got all sorts of pop music, and they have beer. And I'm like, I don't drink, man. Look at me. I eat. Okay, so I want to eat. Like, every 3 hours, I want to eat. And I hate pop music. I'm a big jazz freak, right? So I'm like, no. They said, well, we do know a club. It's a restaurant. It's got jazz music. And if you want, we'll go there instead. They lied. They just wanted to get me out. So we go to this club. We're sitting in the back. And they're playing CDs, you know, and popular tunes, blah, 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 blah. And my buddies say, hey, what do you think of the band? I'm like, well, I don't know. They haven't started yet. No, this is the band. So we wander to the front of the bar. And sure enough, there are these Filipino kids, 17, 18, 19 years old, and they are fantastic. In Asia, all the bars have Filipino bands. Kids from the Philippines are just phenomenal musicians. So every bar you go to in Hong Kong, China, Taiwan, is full of these Filipino bands. And sure enough, the band's fantastic. We start dancing, and, you know, I'm a white guy. I can dance. I got this thing done. You do the overbite, right? You know, and so I got the moves, definitely. And the place is absolutely packed, and I actually find out that I'm having fun, you know, which is something I don't usually do. I look over across the bar, and there's this gorgeous Filipino woman. And looming over her is this huge 350-pound, like, Danish, I found out later, big Danish dude, right? And he's, like, talking in her ear, and you can tell she's really uncomfortable. So I sidle up, and I say, hey, listen, if you want, I'll pretend we're together until this dude leaves, and then, you know, I'll just disappear. She's like, oh, would you? I'm thinking. So I slide in, we start talking, we're having a nice conversation. This guy's giving me the eye. Finally, she leaves to go to the bathroom. Moment of truth, right? This guy goes, hey, dude, I saw her first. Now, I may look big, but this guy's this big. He's fat, but he's still one of those guys that'd sit in you and squish it, you know? But I've been in sales my whole life, so I figure I can pull this off. Hey, man, you had no chance, and you and I both knew it. He's like, you're right. How do you talk to girls like that? I'm like, I'm going to live. She comes back. We're talking. She's not very interested in me for some reason, because I think I'm great. So we're dancing. See, 5 minutes is up, guys. I'll make it fast. The two guys I'm with, Brian, little Irish guy, always talking like the toughest dude in the whole world, little stocky fire plug from Ireland. My other buddy, Simon, is English, 165 pounds, the mildest, meekest dude you've ever met in your life. Just a sweet, sweet man. I love him like a male boss, which he was. All of a sudden, I get this, man, we're in trouble. We're in really big trouble. We're in trouble. I look, and it's Brian, my tough friend. I'm like, what's the deal? I look over, and Simon is nose-to-nose with the biggest Danish guy I've ever seen, right? And he's saying, are you taking a piss at me? You're taking a piss at me? Are you taking a piss at me? I have no idea what that means. It's like, did this guy take a leak on you? What is the deal? That's disgusting, you know? In England, that means, are you giving me crap? Are you teasing me? Something like that. Brian goes, you gotta help. I look at this dude, man. He looks like me on an overhead projector that walked off the wall. He's huge. His arms are like my legs. I'm like, what am I gonna do? You're tough. Help. I'm like, oh man, this worked once tonight. I go over, I give my mean death look. What's going on? In my Clint Eastwood voice. Denmark, they probably don't even know. What's going on? After I get all the parties involved calmed down, I'm like, phew. Like cat of nine lives, I've just gone through two of them, right? And then they're all like, buy you a drink, buy you a drink, buy you a drink, which is the male equivalent of, we're not gonna fight, now we have to be friends or some BS. I gotta drink beer with these guys. I hate beer. I'm drinking beer with these guys from Denmark. We're all buddies. I'm like, fine. Walk back to the Filipino girl who miraculously now is still not interested in me at all. This goes on. Now, this, we got there at 9 p.m. It's now 2 a.m., right? My buddies have been drinking the entire time. I get this whole thing from Brian again. No, we're really in trouble. And I look, and Simon, my mild, meek-mannered boss, is doing the pokey chest thing to the huge, giant Danish guy. And guess who he's standing with? Yeah, fat guy that I chased away and another Danish guy, right? There's three of them, and it's three of the us, but our combined weight is like this guy's leg. So we're in huge trouble, and these guys think I'm going to get him out of it somehow. So I'm like, now there's a thing about guys you got to know. No matter what, we can't run. We can't, we just can't do it. It would be like, did I want to run? Yeah, this guy was huge. I have to figure out a way out of this that's going to make me look like the coolest dude in the bar and not get me killed. And I realized that this was a setup from the very beginning. These are like Danish pirates that hang out in these Hong Kong bars, and they roll stupid English guys that are drunk, and all they had to do was insult the queen, and it was on, right? We're going to end up in the alley, beat up, boom. So I'm thinking, how do I get us out of this and look cool? How do I get us this? I'm inspired. I walk over. I grab my boss by the wrist. I do a fireman's carry, throw him up on my shoulders, walk all the way out of the dance club, right? I look like the coolest dude in the world. Avoided a fight, threw a guy on my shoulders, walked away, and I still don't look like, you know, a pansy. Now, for a mile back to our hotel, I'm carrying him, and he's, let me down, I'm going to kill you, I'm going to kill you, right? Get down, put him down. Brian, the tough guy, comes up, who I always thought was going to be a tough guy. He's Irish, for God's sake. He's like, I just want to go back to the hotel. I just want to go back to the hotel. And I'm like, dude, hey, you don't leave a buddy, blah, blah, blah. Turns out Simon has left his credit card at the bar. So while Brian and I are arguing about should we go back to the credit card or not, Simon takes off running to the bar. Now, he's drunk, but he's fast. He's running back to the bar. I'm arguing, no, we're not going to leave our buddy. I'll go back. All of a sudden, Simon's gone. I mean, he's gone, right? Brian leaves us. He goes back to the hotel. I take off. I'm running after Simon. Believe it or not, I'm not fast. He's about halfway back to the bar when he has to take a leak, okay? So he runs in an alley to take a leak. I pass him. He sees me. I'm chasing him. He's chasing me. By the time we get back to the bar, again, I'm not a runner. I'm like, So we walk into the bar. I said, Simon, you have one chance to live. You're going to walk to the bar. You're going to get your credit card. You're not going to talk to anybody. You're not going to look at anybody. I walk in. I walk right over to the Danish guys. They look at me and go, nice move, mate. I'm like, I'm going to live. That's three. Filipino girl, hey, sailor, nice move. That's my Christmas in Hong Kong. Take care, guys.
Thanks a lot. Jake Weissman.